This is ContraZoom, where we go back and forth about film. I'm your host, Dakota Arsenault. The Vancouver International Film Festival is about to embark on its latest edition. The festival has been running off and on since 1958, and this year's edition will feature over 230 movies from over 70 different countries. Joining the show today to name our most anticipated films playing the fest is Todd Bengali, a critic for the website For Real, who was last heard on episode 230, the Oscar recap extravaganza. So welcome back to the show, Todd. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm really happy to be here. I'm happy to, 230. Wow. Yeah, I'm happy to have returned. Happy to talk about VIFF always.
Well, this is going to be episode 253, so it's definitely been a while since you've been on. So I apologize for that.
No, it's fine. We consider it. It feels like the Oscars were like
forever ago?
A month ago.
Oh, really? I thought it was forever ago.
Yeah, I don't know. Time.
How does it work?
Yeah, I don't know. That's
So a couple weeks ago, we actually met up and VIFF did their launch, in-person launch, where they kind of announced what titles were playing. And you and I were sitting in the theater at the VIFF Center and able to make snarky comments back and forth and be excited about what movies were playing. So that was really fun. So I'm glad that we're able to kind of talk more about the movies we're excited about today.
I'm also very excited for that. I felt the highlight of the launch for me was you and I getting very giddy when we saw Anthony Shim's name on screen.
Yeah, he was curating a section, which is really cool.
Yeah, I'm very excited for his participation in VIFF, especially after I felt Riceway Sleeps was one of the highlights of VIFF last year for me personally. So it's really nice to kind of see that coming back, and also highlights everything I love about VIFF, which is the opportunity to see movies I would not have seen otherwise and kind of fall in love with the filmmakers there.
100%. Yeah, I was late to the Rice Boy Sleeps train. I didn't watch it until just before the Canadian Screen Awards back in like April. So Rachel was bugging me for like 6 months that I need to watch Rice Boy Sleeps, and it took me forever to get to it.
Yeah. Rachel was right, as always.
As always, right? She's not going to listen to this. She's on vacation right now in Memphis visiting Graceland because that's where her Elvis obsession has taken her to these days.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty crazy.
That's super exciting.
Yeah, I'm living for all the photos that she's been posting of her Graceland trip. It's been great. With just some gentle teasing along the way.
Of course, naturally.
Now we picked five movies we're both excited for that are playing this year's VIFF, but I made it a little difficult on you because I gave one condition that I didn't want to repeat movies that we previewed on our TIFF preview episode. So there was a handful of movies that Rachel and I talked about that played TIFF that are also playing VIFF, and so I sort of made this extra difficult for you. But after I put those limitations on you, were you able to narrow down in a bit of an easier manner of what you wanted to talk about today?
Yeah, I think those limitations were actually maybe for the best too, as they made my job a little more exciting. It was still tough actually cutting it down to five, not getting to five. There's a lot I'm really excited to see at this festival, but it meant that Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron, right, was just not on my list, even though it's, I think, for most moviegoers alike, one of the single most anticipated films of the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. So that would have obviously made my list, but that's less of a VIFF pick and more of just, it's, you know, could be Miyazaki's last film. The word has gone both ways on that, but it's another Miyazaki, and it's really exciting to see that. But yeah, no, I thought the exercise in picking five films was almost made easier by not having to overlap with TIFF. So, mm-hmm. Double-edged sword.
Yeah, it looks like the movies that we eliminated would have been The Boy and the Heron, Evil Does Not Exist, A Zone of Interest. I think that was all of them, which, you know, are some pretty notable movies. So it is not that we're not excited to talk about Zone of Interest or see it or The Boy and the Heron. It's just I don't want to be repeating what we already said. So if you haven't listened to our TIFF preview, you can listen to it there, or our TIFF wrap up where Rachel and Jeff Ballmer kind of talked about a lot of the movies that they saw, where some of those are highlighted as well. But all that said, I'd love to know what your first pick is there, Todd.
Sure. So my first pick also played at TIFF, was not talked about on the TIFF podcast, the initial TIFF preview podcast. And that's Anatomy of a Fall, the Palme d'Or winner at this year's Cannes.
I don't know what happened. I think he fell off that third floor. The window's open.
The autopsy report is inconclusive. An accidental fall is going to be hard for us to defend. That's why there's an investigation for a more suspicious death. Because you were the only person there. And of course, you're his wife.
Stop. I did not kill him.
I'm really excited to see this one. I think this one has had a lot of hype going into all the festivals. I think this one's also playing in Edmonton this weekend or next weekend. At the Edmonton Film Festival, I think it's playing the Chicago Film Festival. Anatomy of a Fall is just making all of the rounds right now. It was, I think, just overlooked, actually, as France's pick for the Oscars, if I remember reading that news correctly. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially, from what I understand, which is not much because I obviously have not seen it, is a thriller starring Sandra Hüller, who is also in The Zone of Interest this year, big year for her. And out of France, obviously, psychological. This is basically my favorite genre. And it's a murder mystery from what I understand.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this one too. It did just not, let me reword that. France chose a different movie to be its entry into the Best International Film at the Oscars this year. That doesn't mean Anatomy of a Fall won't get nominated at the Oscars, but the director, Justine Triet, posted on Instagram a very catty message, and the translation is, "To risk winning the International Feature Oscar, France chose not to submit Anatomy of a Fall, Palme d'Or winner and box office hit, almost a million tickets sold, but one of the most boring slash annoying official selections at Cannes. Too much honor to give to a female director, perhaps?" Which I don't think is making her very many friends in the French community these days, calling out someone else's work.
Yeah, wow, that's... Woo!
Yeah, the tea is hot for that one. I'm still very excited for Anatomy of a Fall. I did watch the trailer, and it doesn't really give a ton away other than what is the synopsis of the movie, so that's good. Also, I was a little surprised because the trailer is basically completely in English. I'm like, oh, is this an English language movie? But no, apparently it is mostly in French, and with a little bit of German as well, so I don't know why they decided to cut a trailer just around the English part, but... I guess that's what they decide to do.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm super interested in that tea from Trier. That's especially because the movie that she is referring to is also playing at VIFF this year. So, you know, that'll be very interesting to see if it really is one of the most boring selections.
Boring slash annoying.
Slash annoying.
Yes.
That's just heavy criticism right there for it an is, Instagram yeah. post.
Yeah, yeah. but yeah, this is definitely going to be one that I think is going to be on a lot of people's radars, especially as the fall movie season continues and award season sort of picks up. It could very easily be, you know, one of the highlights of international cinema this year.
Yeah, I fully expect it to be. It's also being distributed by Neon, who, for my money, I'm a real Neon head. I think this is pretty well documented. And so I fully expect this to be just a fantastic movie.
Mm-hmm. I know if I ever start a new podcast series called Neon Retrospective, you'll be my number one guest.
Yeah, it'll be hard to keep me off of it. I'll be like, we're talking about every Neon movie right now. And you're like, no, we're pacing ourselves. I'm like, we're just not going to stop potting until we've hit the end of this wiki page.
Yes. All right. So for my first movie, it is called I Used to Be Funny. And Sam Cowell used to be funny. I'm using the VIF website to give the descriptions because I figured it was easier than writing my own thing. So Sam Cowell used to be funny. She used to spend her nights working the comedy clubs of Toronto and her days as an au pair for Brooke, a young teen struggling with the recent passing of her mother. Now Sam hides from the world, tormented by PTSD from an unseen event. Faced with the news that Brooke has fled home, Sam struggles to make the choice whether or not to help track down the missing teen or leave the past behind. Now, I'm excited for this for a few reasons. One, I like that it's a movie that takes place in Toronto, so that's very exciting. I'm always there for that. Two, it stars Rachel Sennett, which before we were recording, we were just talking about her and the fact that I just watched Bottoms and how incredible she is. And three, I'm excited for the director, Ali Pankhiu, who has kind of been an up-and-coming Canadian director for a little bit. She did one of the Black Mirror episodes in the most recent series that came out. So all of this kind of coming together, I'm very sort of excited to see how this works out. I've already got tickets secured for this one, so I'm definitely going to be there for this one. But yeah, was this one that you had heard of at all or was on your radar?
Yeah, absolutely. This one was big on my radar, as you know, anything with Rachel Sennett is. And yeah, this was one that I considered putting in my five, but I knew you had tickets secured. And I was like, that feels a little rude. It's also Toronto. I know, obviously, you have the home connection there. I do not. So, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to this one, though. This is also near the top of my list.
Nice. Are you going to be attending that screening?
I don't know if my schedule allows for it. My schedule is very strange because I work most evenings and nights. So I have a strange schedule. For this VIF in particular.
That makes sense. Yeah, because I'm currently not working, my VIF is completely open. So I'm going to see more than I've ever have. So I'm very excited for the amount of movies that I'm going to see, but also already feeling overwhelmed by how much work that will also correlate into afterwards.
Yeah, it's the double-edged sword. But hey, we support the strike. And if it means that you get to watch more movies, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a great way of putting it. Okay, what is your next pick?
My next pick, we're moving back up the alphabet, actually, even though we're both going in alphabetical order here. Then my next pick is Goodbye, Julia. So I will also defer to the VIF website's description of the movie. And the lead up to the secession of South Sudan, Mona, a well-to-do retired singer from the North, becomes complicit in hushing up the murder of a southerner at the hands of her overtly prejudiced husband. Guilt-ridden about the role in catalyzing this turn of events, Mona hires the victim's unknowing widow, Julia, as her live-in maid in a secret bid at making amends. Whilst a complicated friendship blooms between the two women, the threat of discovery looms ever present. This is another, I think, less psychological thriller, just more kind of suspense film. Which, as you can see, I've a genre I naturally defer towards. It was also the first ever Sudanese film to play at Cannes. It's also been making the rounds this year, and I'm quite excited to watch this film because I don't think I've ever seen a film from Sudan, if I'm being correct in my recollection. I also have certainly never seen a film from Sudan that deals with the separation of the state between North and South, which, you know, happened in the last couple of decades. And so it'll be very interesting to see how this piece plays as a kind of reflection of internal turmoil within these families, but also as a larger statement on the separation into two countries. So I don't know. I'm very excited. I always look for films from other parts of the world, and Sudan is a part of the world that I've never been to, and I don't think I've ever seen a film from. So
yeah, that's utterly fascinating. I didn't see that when I was going through the VIF listings. I must have skipped over it, but that sounds really interesting. I definitely have not seen a Sudanese film before. I've only seen a handful of African films, so it's a huge blind spot for me, the entire continent and their filmography. But I always love when sort of countries that don't have as long of a history making movies gets into the game and is able to like showcase some truly original artworks and make the medium in a way that suits their culture's way of storytelling, which is always interesting because, you know, you can look back of cinema has been around for over 100 years now, and every once in a while a country will pop up that doesn't really have a rich history of making movies, and they'll be like, yeah, okay, this is how you do it, you know, in Hollywood or elsewhere in the West or in Asia, but you know what, we're going to do our own version of storytelling. It's such a unique and fresh take on movies in general that it's exciting to watch, even if, you know, it's not the most polished movie or it's missing some other things, but because of the way that they go in with for the pure artistic intent, it's always so interesting. So the description and the fact that, like, I've never even seen a Sudanese film before, I don't even know how many they've made before, sounds very interesting to me.
Yeah, I just checked. I actually have seen a Sudanese film, You Will Die at 20, which is a couple of years old. I think 2019 is when this came out, and it might be on the Criterion Channel. I don't know where I watched it. Maybe it was Movie. This is another kind of festival darling of its time. A really, really good movie. That's a side recommendation. Yeah, You Will Die at 20 is from Sudan. It is a very good film. But other than that, looking at the list of films produced from Sudan, I have not seen any of these others. So this will join a very, very short list of two.
That's really cool. Nice. Yeah. Okay, so my next one, which you were nice enough to also leave for me to include in my picks, is Monster, which is Monster appears to be the story of a boy named Minato and the abuse he faces at the hands of his school teacher, Mr. Hori. But as the film explores the same events through different perspectives, notions of blame get scrambled in what might be described as a moral mystery tale. Now, there's one reason and one reason only why this movie is on my list, and that is because it's directed by Hirokazu Koreeda, who is, in my opinion, one of the best working directors today. He's made films such as Shoplifters or Broker. Broker is one of my favorite movies last year, Like Father, Like Son, Nobody Knows. He is an absolutely prolific Japanese film director who in the last decade or so has just been pumping out hit after hit. And I can't wait to see what he does with Monster because he's just such a fantastic director. Both him and Hamaguchi, who, you know, Evil Does Not Exist is playing at VIFF, and so I said that it's ineligible for this show. The two of them are just like, oh, there's a new Hamaguchi or new Koreeda. I'm sold. You don't really need to tell me much else other than that.
Yeah.
But even the subject matter, this sounds very interesting and very different from his previous films, which have been lighter and fair. This seems like it's definitely more of a serious tone for him.
Right. Yeah. I'm very excited for this one as well. Obviously, like you just said, Hamaguchi, Koreeda, there's a short list of kind of names in contemporary cinema where I see the name and that's, I'm just like, yeah, man, you don't even need to tell me the movie name. Like, I could show up at the box office and be like, I'm here for Jordan Peele's movie. They'd be like, okay. That's how I feel about Koreeda. I'm very much looking forward to a more serious tone. I thought Broker straddled a really fine line between being light and also kind of emotionally devastating in terms of its family portrayal. Monster, I'm not expecting to be light. So, hence the name.
I'm very excited by the fact that the last words I said were a moral mystery tale. And that just sounds so intriguing to me of what he's going to craft, because he already is very good at sort of weaving together so many different narratives and structures. And the fact that it seems like, based on the description they're giving out, sounds more like a two-hander, whereas most of his films have been larger ensemble pieces. It's going to be interesting to sort of see what he does focusing the story on two people.
Yeah, I'm also very excited for that. I think one of the things that Corita does super well is that he's able to bring the minute out of these larger ensembles. I think you're able to get a lot of that really beautiful, like, one-on-one chemistry between his actors, even in larger group settings. It's something I've always really appreciated about his films. I felt this way about Broker last year. There's also an immense there's immense acting talent in all of his films, but Broker last year was a great ensemble cast, right? And so I am really interested in seeing how he's going to bring that out in just a two-person type movie where he doesn't have to kind of push folks out of frame in the screenplay or separate the characters in the actual screenplay itself and just focus on those characters and their connection and whatever they're hunting for in this mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to put it. What is the next movie that you're excited about?
So the next movie, this is a real change of genre from what we've been talking about. The next movie is On the Adamant. This is a documentary. I come from a big documentary household. We love documentaries. So, On the Adamant, moored on the Seine in central Paris, not far from the city's main cultural landmarks, is a huge floating barge known as the Adamant, an institutional psychotherapy day center where patients are co-authors of their care. A sanctuary for adults with mental disorders, the institution is unique in both architecture and approach, offering its visitors a range of counseling, education, and cultural activity, with a special emphasis on art therapy. This is a documentary from France, so the second French film I've put on my list here. And this won the Golden Bear at Berlinale, which is what initially put it on my radar back in the spring. Berlinale is, I tend to look to their award winners more than other film festivals, because I think that the award winners in Berlin always are films that are not films that you would hear about otherwise. So last year they had Alcaraz, which also played a VIFF, I believe, the Carla Simone film. And the year before that, they had Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn win the Golden Bear, which is a Romanian film that is just as wild as the name suggests, like really one of the more provocative and, what's the word I'm looking for? Rightful to COVID depictions in contemporary cinema of this decade. A very good film. This year they've awarded it to a documentary. I'm very excited about that. As someone who has done their fair share of art therapy, but also dealt with mental disorders and psychological care, On the Adamant just seems entirely up my alley. And I trust the jury at Berlin every year, and they have yet to fail me. So that's where I'm at.
Nice. That's also one that I wasn't familiar with. And so I'm glad you're talking about it, because it does sound very interesting. It sounds like it's going to be a very heavy subject matter. So it's definitely one that you'll probably have to go in and embracing yourself for not probably having the happiest of experience at times while watching this, but hopefully it's a very richly rewarding film nonetheless.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pair this with something super light and fluffy. Maybe the new Corita.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What's your next film, Dakota?
So my next one, I'm going to actually continue the documentary train, and that is Mr. Dress-Up, The Magic of Make-Believe.
Oh, here you are. You're here and we're here. I've got a good bat costume here to show you.
Didn't matter what race you were, what color you were, what religion you were, what language you spoke, you watched Mr. Dress-Up.
Ernie Coombs, Mr. Dress-Up, I mean, he was just so kind and gentle.
Ernie never forgot a child within him, and that informs everything that he does with children.
When you tell people that Fred Rogers and Ernie Coombs came to Canada together, most people don't even realize that they were very close friends.
For three decades, Ernie Coombs, aka Mr. Dress-Up, was a fixture in Canadian living rooms. Over the course of some 4,000 episodes, he imparted a simple but essential advice: always put the caps on your markers. And quietly went about leading by example when it came to teaching generations of children how to be better people. Now, I'm actually sort of curious about this, because you are not Canadian. Do you know who Mr. Dressup is?
I'm going to be honest with you. I talked with my partner about this yesterday. I had not heard of Mr. Dressup until this documentary like appeared on the list. And so I just approached them and was like, who is this fake Mr. Rogers? What is this? Do I need to watch this? And I got all of the info. Yeah, I got accosted for being like, first of all, not fake Mr. Rogers. But also, yeah, it seems he seems like a real, like genuine mainstay in Canadian culture. I would love to hear more about that from you, though.
Yeah. So I've actually watched this movie. I watched it last night, the night before we were recording this. I got a screener of it, and it's absolutely incredible. This is going to be a very easy movie for people to watch because it is coming to Amazon Prime a couple weeks after the festival. So it'll be available for everyone to see. And I think this is going to be a bit of a hit among Canadians, or at least a very talked about movie, because he really was such an iconic person. And it's sort of funny that you bring up the idea of who is this fake Mr. Rogers, when in reality, Mr. Rogers and Mr. Dressup actually got their start together, because Mr. Dressup is American. And so they'd started in Pittsburgh together, came up to Canada, and Canada was the first time Mr. Rogers was actually put on TV. And then when he left, Mr. Dressup got his own show. Ernie Coombs got his own show and became a staple in Canada in the same way that Mr. Rogers was a staple in the US, although we also saw him up here as well, on our TVs. But yeah, this is definitely the type of documentary where I feel like it's not going to have the same impact on you. I watched it, and it's definitely, you need a full box of tissues with you, because you're going to be emotional the whole time, basically sort of reliving your childhood years. And it also has like a who's who of Canadian celebrities, where I don't know if they're going to be as household names to people that didn't grow up in Canadian culture, basically singing the praises of Ernie Coombs and the Mr. Dressup show. So it's really fascinating, a beautiful, beautiful documentary that kind of, you know, sheds some light over who he was as a person, and also the history of the show. And then bringing it all together with some really interesting behind the scenes photos and recordings and things like that. That was just absolutely fascinating to see. So I don't normally like including movies on my preview list that I've already seen, but I think it's one that, if people aren't aware of it, definitely should have it on their radars.
That's really good. I do plan on watching this film. That being said, should I like recreate a Canadian childhood for myself? Should I just spend one whole day watching Mr. Dressup before I see this movie? Is it important to have seen episodes, or?
I like the idea of that. The concept of it is hilarious, but it's definitely more of a sort of a preschooler show, very similar to the vibe that Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood also had. So like, yeah, if you want to learn some cool arts and crafts projects and learn what it's like to be a patient's child who has adults that listen to them, then yeah, you know what? You should definitely check out some episodes. It probably will be worth your time and make you feel like a kid again.
It would be the first time anyone has ever made me feel like a patient child. So that would be absolutely beneficial.
Well, I'm very excited and curious to see what you think of it afterwards. So I'm going to have to keep tabs on whether or not you end up watching it.
All right, I will let you know. I will let you know.
Please do. What is your next movie?
So my next movie, much like yours, is one that people will get the opportunity to see. I always forget when I'm doing preview episodes for festivals, and I find like obscure gems that I'm really looking forward to seeing, that then it means that like me and a couple hundred other people are going to get to see them. And unless you live in Sudan, Goodbye Julia might be hard to come by in the coming months. This next film, much like Mr. Dressup, everyone will be able to see. This is the Canadian premiere of Sofia Coppola's Priscilla.
Priscilla, what about boys at school? Must be some handsome ones.
This is my most anticipated film of the festival. Was really glad it didn't play at TIFF, so that there was no chance of it being taken from me here. For those at home that have not somehow heard about this movie before it plays, Priscilla Bulot? I don't know how to say it. It's Presley to me. Priscilla is just 14 when she meets Elvis Presley on a U.S. military base in Germany, 1959. Courteous, respectful, and a little sad, he sweeps her off her feet. He's Elvis, after all. Next thing she knows, she's living in Graceland with Rachel. Nope, that says with the King of Rock and Roll, not Rachel Ho. My fault. And his daddy, Vernon, still finishing her schooling, still a virgin. Her fairy tale romance is eventually consummated, but it's not before she's reading about her new husband's onset fling with Anne Margaret. And while her domestic situation might be the object of envy for most, Priscilla begins to understand it comes with zero autonomy. She's a kept woman, a trophy wife, caught in a trap, you might say. This is seemingly like the polar opposite. Actually, that's the exact phrase they use on the VIF website. Wow, polar opposite right there at the top. Of Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, which premiered last year. This is the inverse, about the other side of that relationship. And Sofia Coppola is in very short company for my favorite working filmmaker. I've seen all of her films. At least three of her films are some of my favorite ever. The Beguiled, Lost in Translation, and Marie Antoinette. I just love Coppola. I will be in attendance for this film. It plays one time at VIFF, and then will play many, many, many times in many theaters across the nations at the end of this year. So
first off, I want to give a huge shout out for you loving The Beguiled, because that is an absolutely underrated movie that I don't know how many times I recommended to people, and they're like, oh, that sounds interesting. I'm like, yes, watch it, please. It's really, really good.
It's a masterpiece. Just a true masterpiece.
Yeah. I'm mad at you that you took this pick from me, because this is also my number one most anticipated movie. And unfortunately, spoiler alert, I will not be able to make the screening. I am absolutely devastated that I can't make it, because Coppola is also in my, top tier of favorite directors ever, and very excited about this. And I think she is the right person to do Priscilla Presley justice and tell her side of the story, which I know she's a very complicated figure on her own. And the relationship she had with Elvis is also extremely complicated, especially since he more or less groomed her because she was a minor at the time, and he was definitely not a minor at the time. And so there's a whole bunch of ethical questions that I'm sure Sofia Coppola will end up exploring in her film. So I'm very excited to see this. And, I've seen the trailer. It just looks absolutely gorgeous, as all Sofia Coppola movies do.
Right. It's going to be real in terms of its set design and its world building. I'm very excited for that. But also, when I found out that the Presley estate had not signed off on any of his music being used for the film, there was not a more like, oh, well, that's okay kind of filmmaker for me than Sofia Coppola, because she's done this before. I mean, Marie Antoinette very famously has a soundtrack that is not of classical Renaissance music, Victorian music, right? It's a pop soundtrack for a movie set hundreds of years ago. So this idea of making a Presley film without the music of Elvis, I was like, oh, well, if anyone has it, Coppola's got it. Like, she'll be fine. So I think this is absolutely just in the right hands, and I'm super excited. I'm very excited. I will enjoy it for the both of us.
Yes, thank you. Please do. I think it's almost like a badge of honor when a film deals with an artist and the estate goes, we don't want you using their actual work, because it means that they're probably exposing some real truths that they don't want out there. So it's going to be very interesting to sort of see what they do with it. I'm pretty sure Thomas Mars, who is Sofia Coppola's husband, who is the frontman for the band Phoenix, is doing the score for Priscilla, much like how in Marie Antoinette, as you talked about, the anachronistic score was using mostly Phoenix music, but they were already released Phoenix songs. I think this is now going to be original, not quite Phoenix music, but Thomas Mars music, which is very interesting. And it's also interesting considering how Baz Luhrmann and Sofia Coppola both use anachronistic music for their movies. And while I think it fits incredibly well for Sofia Coppola's movies, it is probably one of my biggest criticisms of Baz Luhrmann, in that the music he chooses really just does not fit. And I know he very much is a, you're either on his wavelength or you're not director. And I'm really not on a Luhrmann wavelength. And so every time he uses one of, like, throws a rap song in The Great Gatsby, and it just makes me go, oh, why would you choose this song of all songs, sort of thing. So I'm very excited to see what Coppola is going to do, considering the fact that she does not have access to Elvis's actual music.
Yeah, I'm fully anticipating it being, the soundtrack being an album I throw on my Spotify and listen to while I work or work out or whatever the case may be. Because that kind of tends to be how I roll with her films, even the films I don't love of hers. But yeah, I am completely in agreement with you there.
Nice. Okay, so for my next one, I'm actually a little surprised it's not on your list, because I don't know if it was one that you came across or not, but it definitely seems up your alley. It is called Only the River Flows. A serial killer terrorizes a tiled roof hamlet of barely 50 families. Detective Maji is in charge of the investigation and faces challenges that make his job even harder. His team is incompetent, the locals are cagey, and his wife is going through a difficult pregnancy. The time and location are no accident. The events of the film take place between the Tiananmen Square protests and China's economic boom. Shame and secrecy are rampant, and the killer takes full advantage of. So this is a movie that I'm not familiar with anyone involved with it. The director is Wei Shuzhen, which I have not seen any of their films. I don't recognize any of the actors in this, but just this idea. And I'm always a little nervous about watching mainland Chinese films due to their political bent usually. But this movie seems to be grappling with the Tiananmen Square protests and massacre of Chinese citizens who were protesting. And so that kind of perks my ears up a little bit, that that has my interest, because every once in a while, mainland China does produce some really interesting work that is critical of its government. And I am wondering if this is one of those cases. And the fact that it basically kind of looks like a, not quite a whodunit, but definitely I do love a good mystery thriller, really has me intrigued about it.
Yeah, this, I actually had looked at this film. It's all of its scheduled times, all of its screening times, I guess the actual phrase there, are conflict with something else that I have, right? So it plays on that Saturday and I'm going to be at the Zone of Interest or whatever the case may be. I think actually when it plays on the Saturday, I'm going to be at like the Promised Land or something. But yeah, this is right up my alley. You completely nailed that. I love neo-noirs. I love noir. You know, I just big mystery crime person. So yeah, I'm going to try my best to see this film. I would also love to kind of see where it lands politically on the mainland Chinese bent, because that is absolutely true. I tend to love Chinese films that do skewer the government, or at least don't bend at the will of the government. There was a film a couple of years ago, which I believe was Chinese and not from Hong Kong, called Better Days. That dealt.
Oh yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah, Better Days was, you know, quite critical, I think, of the Chinese education system and the pressures that it puts on students, as well as being, if I remember correctly, a kind of overly long teenage love story as well. But yeah, I'll be very interested in seeing this one if I can get my hands on it or show up to a screening. Yeah.
Yeah, there's one that Better Days I did watch, because it was nominated at the Oscars for Best International Film when it came out. Mm-hmm. And it was a movie that I liked its ideas, but the melodrama was a bit too heavy for me at times. So I think in the end, I was a little mixed on it.
Yeah, I think I came down somewhere similar on it. I remember it being long. I remember it definitely being extra moody. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. All right, what is your last movie that you are excited about?
My last one did play at TIFF, if I am correct, but did not make the preview episode, thankfully. It's The Royal Hotel. This is Kitty Green's follow-up, the Australian filmmaker. Her follow-up to The Assistant from 2019. The Assistant was a single-hander with Julia Garner, essentially playing the titular assistant to the unnamed Harvey Weinstein in a chamber piece drama. It was very good. Completely put Kitty Green on the map for me. Was a real showcase for Julia Garner as well. In this film, Julia Garner returns to play Hannah. Hannah is backpacking across Australia with her best friend Liv. Running low on funds, they decide that a job tending bars in an outback mining town might be a lark. The job comes with free lodging, after all, and not a little booze. The owner, Billy, does his best to keep the rowdy regulars in order, but then again, he's always drunk himself. Beer culture is a place like this is always going to be a wild ride, but the young women have no idea just how quickly the bottom can drop out of their world. The co-star in this film is Jessica Henwick, who's one of my favorite actresses working today. I've seen just about everything she's been in the last couple of years. Speaking of Sofia Coppola, she had a part in On the Rocks that I thought she was very good in. That was the same year she did Love and Monsters, Underwater. Then she was in The Matrix Resurrections. I think most audiences will have seen her most recently as the assistant in Glass Onion, the second Knives Out film. She is probably best known for her work in Game of Thrones. I think she's just a wonderful, wonderful actress, and as is Julia Garner. So I'm very excited to see how these two, speaking of two-handers, as we were talking about with Corrieta, I'm very excited to see how these two play it on screen for The Royal Hotel.
Yeah, this is one that's high up on my list as well. I absolutely adored The Assistant. It was so devastating, and I think probably, in my opinion, the definitive Me Too movement movie as well. So great, agree. Julia Garner. Yeah, you came to see Julia Garner on something outside of, I'm blanking on the Netflix show she was on.
Ozark.
Thank you very much. Gain her to see a different side of her acting abilities than Ozark, which she's also incredible on. So I'm very excited about this. And it's funny, you talk about Jessica Henwick. I was like, yeah, I recognize her name. I don't know if I've seen her or anything. And, you know, as you're talking about what she's been, I pulled up her IMDb page. I'm like, oh, I've seen almost everything that she's been in. I don't know how I don't know her by now.
She's like a real, like, oh, she's in this?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely all, for the most part, like supporting roles. So it's nice that she's breaking out and getting some lead roles here because, yeah, she is really great, especially in Glass Onion. I love her as the Kate Hudson's assistant in that movie, which the two of them have great chemistry together. I always think of the line when she's like, you didn't think sweatpants were made in sweatshops, did you, or something like that. Whatever the punchline is, I'm obviously butchering it, but it's the funniest moment in the film for me.
Please tell me you did not think sweatshops are where they make sweatpants. Oh my God.
But yeah, I'm very excited for this. Also because it co-stars Australian legend Hugo Weaving as the hotel owner. So always great seeing Hugo Weaving pop up in things. And he looks like he's got like his menacing side back, which I always like him when he's in that mode. But yeah, Julia Garner and Jessica Henwick together leading this movie looks very interesting. And Kitty Green is really someone that needs to be watched for being, you know, the next major director to blow up.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think this will be interesting because Henwick was in the new Matrix movie, but Hugo Weaving was not. So we will get the kind of the uniting of these two that we did not get from. She had a kind of significant part in Matrix. Was it Resurrections?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I love Hugo Weaving. Be very exciting to see him back on the big screen.
Okay, and then my last movie is one called The Teacher's Lounge. New to her school, Miss Nowak is reluctantly drawn into the interrogation of two sixth grade class representatives after a series of thefts. They cast suspicion on a Turkish classmate, Ali, despite his proclamation of innocence, even after a search turns up a surprisingly fat wallet. Convinced racism is at play, the teacher decides to set up a sting operation to uncover the true culprit. So this was originally a movie that was not on my radar at all, and it wasn't until the our TIFF wrap-up episode where Jeff Ballmer named The Teacher's Lounge as his favorite movie that he saw at the festival, the best thing that he saw. So because of that recommendation, it is now very high up on my list because I trust his judgment, and I'm very excited about this. This is a German film. So it just looks really interesting. And the image that they use to promote this movie is, I'm guessing, the woman who plays the main teacher screaming, looking like mm-hmm. she's about to cry or something like that. And because of that, that's a very provocative image. It just sounds very interesting. So I don't know anyone involved with this movie as far as the director or the cast. But Germany, I love their cinema. So you know what? You can't really go wrong with a great German flick.
Absolutely not. This one also was put on my radar following TIFF, and I'm hoping to make it to one of the screenings for this film as well. This also sounds very much up my alley.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's going to sort of be one of those movies that's hard to pin down its genre. Seems like it's got a lot going for it, so it's going to be very interesting to sort of see how it plays out, and I'm very excited for this one.
Yeah. Do we want to do honorable mentions?
I mean, if you've got some honorable mentions, please shout them out.
I do have some honorable mentions. I'm very, very much looking forward to The Promised Land, which I will be seeing the same day I'm seeing The Zone of Interest. Are you seeing that as well?
It is on my radar to go to because, yeah, that's the day where it's The Promised Land followed by Anatomy of a Fall, followed by The Zone of Interest, all at the Playhouse, which seems like the most stacked day you could have.
It is pretty stacked. I'm actually not seeing Anatomy of a Fall that day. I have tickets secured for its second showing, I think Monday. But I will be at Promised Land. I will be at The Zone of Interest. I'm looking forward to both of those. There are a handful of other films. The Delinquents is one of them that I'm really looking forward to. Obviously, The Boy and the Heron. And I'm sitting next to my Drive My Car Criterion. So, of course, Hamaguchi is always on the board. This is just a really good lineup. I just wanted to shout out a whole bunch of things because the lineup this year is very good, as it is most years, but yeah, very good this year.
Yeah. A couple of my other honorable mentions would be La Chimera, which I don't know if it's in English or in French. I'm a little unsure about that, but I'm excited about it. Seven Veils, the new Adam Egoyan movie. I know he's been really more on the miss side of the hit or miss with his last few films, but I'm still sort of curious to see if he's maybe reclaimed some of his past greatness. Irina's Vow was a movie that a friend of the show, Brody Cottenham, saw during TIFF and really liked it and was recommending it. So I might try to check that out. And then, of course, Fallen Leaves, which is the opening night film. I don't think I'll be able to get into the opening night film, but it is having a second screening that I'm going to try to get to.
I am also going to try to be at that second screening. That's on Monday, right?
It is, yeah, the Monday, October 2nd. Yeah. Nice 12:45 in the afternoon, so hopefully everyone is stuck at work and there's no big lineup for it.
That's what I'm thinking, right? I love these midday screenings because I can hit those easy. So I'll probably see you there.
Yeah, there unfortunately isn't enough of the midday screenings. It seems like for the most part, the movies start at like 4 or 5. I'm just like, okay, I love some noon, 1 o'clock, be able to squeeze another one in.
Like, just, like, kind of get my day going at home. I head out, like, 11, grab a coffee, kick around for a bit, go see a movie. Yeah, would love that. I'll definitely hit you up before Fallen Leaves. We'll get our festival opening film in the middle of the festival.
Of course, yes, yeah. And I know we're also trying to organize some sort of a meetup, so it's nice if we can get all of our Pacific Northwest movie friends together with Matthew Simpson and Thomas Stoneham Judge and the Taylors and all those great people who will also be covering the festival. It'll be nice if we can hopefully all get together. And if we do, we'll have to post a picture or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be great.
Well, Todd, I really want to thank you for coming on today and sharing your picks. I'm sure you're going to be super busy and generating a lot of great content for VIFF. But where can people find more of your work, follow you? Do you have anything that you want to promote right now? Give us the goods.
The goods. The goods are This Is For Real, two E's and real, no A's. That's where all of my VIFF content is going to be published. I should have stuff coming up in the next week or so, coinciding with the kickoff of VIFF on the 28th. So keep an eye there. You can follow This Is For Real on social media. You can follow me on social media at Todd_Complex, I believe, on pretty much all social media. So yeah, those two places will have links to all of my work for VIFF. And that's them the goods.
Nice. Well, I'll make sure to link to all of that in the show notes. And yeah, definitely check out Todd's work at thisisforreal.com because it is a fantastic site that Thomas Stoneham Judge runs. And all of the writers there are so talented. And I'm always jealous of your incredible work.
We are likewise very jealous. We're always talking about the podcast that we get to come on. And so it's a real pleasure.
Nice. Well, thank you very much. This has been a That Shelf podcast. Visit thatshelf.com for more great film discourse. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at ContraZoomPod. What are you most excited about that's playing at VIFF? Send an email to ContraZoomPod@gmail.com. Thank you to Eric and Kevin Smale for the theme music and to Stephanie Pryor for the logo design. If you like to listen to podcasts on YouTube, we do post all episodes there as well. And if you really like the show, consider tipping us on coffee. Thanks for checking us out.